It is Sunday, September 28th. I am Zach Barnett. Once again, your backup turned starting quarterback for the Football Scoop podcast. I am joined. This is a one-on-one affair. I'm joined by John Bryce, college football expert. John, how are you?
I'm good, Zach. You're the starter now in my playbook. So number one in the program, number one on the depth chart.
All right, let's start with the Alabama-Georgia game. I just want to say generally, before we get into any of this, and I know I'm far from the first person to point this out, but week to week, the theatrics and the drama and just the images that the SEC produces is unmatched by any other league in college football. It is just, if you just park your remote on ABC from 11 a.m. Central to about 11 p.m. Central, and you're going to be treated to some great football and some great drama week in, week out. And the ABC obviously realized that when they went all in with the SEC, but that they're still, the SEC is still underpaid for what they produce. I mean, going from LSU Ole Miss to Alabama, Georgia was just incredible.
It was high theater. And of course that day had begun with Notre Dame eviscerating Arkansas in the Lou Holtz Bowl and prompting writing from you and writing from me all over Football Scoop about the future of Sam Pittman, which is an insult to call it tenuous because it's not even that. It's bound to be beyond that. As you note this morning, there's about a $3 million incentive to potentially wait two more games or three more games to part ways with Sam Pittman. But in the SEC, you'll never convince me that football decisions are made over $3 million. So a great weekend of college football. It started all the way back on Thursday night when East Carolina got an ugly but effective win against Army. And then Friday night was high stakes theater, and it carried on all over Saturday, all over the country. You're right. It's not just the compelling action that is captured on ABC, but the scenes from every game. There are just incredible moments all the way into the Alabama-Georgia game late last night, where there's a Georgia fan in complete incredulity or befuddlement or any other adjective you want to describe for the fact that he couldn't believe what he was seeing. And that was Alabama waltzing into Sanford Stadium and using Big Al to trample all over the dogs, Zach.
So let's start there. It was the first time in 72 games I saw that Georgia has not held a lead at any point in the contest. So Alabama was undoubtedly the better team in the game. Did you come away thinking that Alabama was the better team, period?
Alabama was the better team last night. Alabama is more complete, I think, overall. The way it played last night, they had gotten a couple of key contributors back, especially on the defensive side of the ball and then on the defensive line. And we had discussed a couple of weeks ago, Zach. I talked to some SEC coaches, including some coaches with direct ties to the Georgia program, and they were incredibly worried going into the game against Tennessee because they didn't feel like, they being Georgia, they didn't feel like they had the dynamics on offense to keep pace with the Vols. Now, that day, Mike Bobo looked like Kalen DeBoer and Spencer Grubb, the way that he worked the Vols' defense of Tim Banks. But yesterday, he looked far more pedestrian. That Georgia offense looked far more pedestrian. And then Georgia didn't capitalize on opportunities. So, yeah, I don't think you can exit that game. Like Alabama didn't score a late touchdown off of a turnover and win by a fluke. Alabama won that game because it controlled it in an incredibly hostile environment, wire to wire. So, yeah, for now, I'll say that Alabama is the better team. Now they have to go prove it, much like Ole Miss a year ago. They have to show that they can handle success.
I think the player of the game was obviously Ty Simpson, but the second player of the game was Ryan Grubb. You saw the difference. Alabama probably loses that game last season without Grubb, and he's proven to be a difference maker. He's proven the work he's done with Ty Simpson, especially since week one, he was indecisive. Timing wasn't down. The work they've done in the month since that game has obviously paid off. And I think if you switch quarterbacks last night, you switch outcomes, and Georgia might win that game by 10-plus points. I think for Georgia to be I don't want to be too harsh on the kid because I was incredibly effusive in my praise in that Tennessee win. But I came away thinking Georgia doesn't have a quarterback to go seriously compete for a national championship. Gunnar Stockton, 13-20, 130 yards. Obviously had a perfectly placed ball drop that should have been a touchdown, but so did Alabama, so you kind of wash those away. But as the Georgia coach told you, they're just not dynamic enough, at least dynamic enough consistently to win these games. And then credit to Alabama, because I've said that when Georgia needs to go score a touchdown, it's basically a hurricane level force of nature. And twice Georgia had the ball in the fourth quarter, needed to score a touchdown, and twice the Alabama defense withstood.
Yeah, I think your point on Grubb is a very good one, and I would not disagree that he was the MVP yesterday, particularly with that late game call to seal it. You know, you got some guerrilla assets when you can go and do that on the road like that and don't play it conservatively and do just say, we're going to win it. We're going to win it right now. I thought that was an emphatic statement from them. And I couldn't agree more. Like for as much as the dogs have loved Gunnar Stockton. And again, we've noted previously, they didn't particularly tell Carson Beck he would be oh so welcomed back into the program after that SEC championship. I think they all agreed it was time for a fresh start for all. But I've seen Gunnar Stockton in person, and he's in that Stetson Bennett and in that Jake Fromm mold. He's probably the lesser passer of those three and the better runner of those three. And now Georgia doesn't have the same type of talent around him on both lines of scrimmage and both sides of the ball that it had under Bennett and Fromm. And I think that's why you're seeing Georgia gettable. Georgia looks gettable. And I know last week sometime when we had the discussion, I think you said you'd take Georgia and Ohio State versus the field. And I pushed back on that a little bit. And but Ohio State to me is the clear cut number one. But then I think there's a whole lot of wide open spaces in college football beyond that.
So if he was here, I would love to get Doug's thoughts on Georgia's fourth down. And unfortunately, he's not. But fortunately, he did quote tweet my tweet on my Kirby Smart, my article on Kirby Smart about it. And he said, Georgia got what they wanted going tempo here. Quad to the boundary, inside shade by field D lineman. No true edge player, so should have been a foot race to the edge. Dogs just didn't execute and allowed inside penetration.
And here's and I didn't disagree with that. I had a friend debating me over Georgia not just kicking the tying field goal right there at home at that moment in time. And here's the only thing that I'm still a little shocked about that. I know Georgia wanted to go tempo, but I was still very shocked that there wasn't a measurement there. I thought that Stockton's run when he needed like 3 yards and he dove for it, I thought he got 2.5 yards or so. I thought it was close enough that there would have been a measurement. And I still think Georgia could have lined up and gone tempo after a measurement and still been okay. Like it wouldn't be the same tempo, but you're still getting the chain gang out of the way and you're already coming up to the line of scrimmage ready to go. And as soon as the ref moves and blows it, you can snap the ball when you're ready. So that's the only thing that I thought. I would like to see it again, but I felt like it was close enough to have warranted a measurement, but I have no issues with going for it right there because you're at home. Like on the road, maybe you kick the field goal and you tie it. But at home, you have to expect your defense. If you don't make it, then you feel really good that you're going to, but you would have to expect your defense is going to keep the opposition pinned down when they're taking the field with the opponent inside its negative 10.
Yeah, Kirby said after the game they've run that exact play in that situation plenty of times, and it's been successful for them. And Doug's absolutely right. They got the look they wanted. LT Overton just beat Georgia's right tackle in that situation. And that's football. But the one thing he did second guess was going tempo and then not substituting out Cash Jones, who's they're basically their pass catching back. Entered the game with only 3 carries on the season and finished Saturday night with 2 carries for -7 yards. So when you have the biggest carry of the game and you have by far the most successful running back in the game in Chauncey Bowens, who's 119 yards and nearly 10 a carry, that's tough. That's the one that if I'm a Georgia fan, that's going to bother me. And then I thought it was interesting that I came of age as a college football observer when Mack Brown couldn't go to the grocery store, couldn't beat Baylor without his five-game losing streak to Oklahoma being brought up. And at no point in his tenure did Mack have a winning percentage as poor as Kirby Smart's is now 1-7 against Alabama. And he said he's not going to lose any sleep over this. Everyone else struggles with Alabama, which is undoubtedly true, but everyone else also struggles with Georgia. I wrote last the gap between Georgia's winning percentage against everyone else and against Alabama is 767. That's an entire Hall of Fame level career in gap between Georgia and Alabama. So on the one hand, it is what it is. It's kind of pointless to pursue Kirby too much about it when it's clear he doesn't care about it. But do you think – I kind of think not even enough is made about this. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think part of not enough being made about it, Zach, is because the fact that Alabama and Georgia just don't play every year. And that was the first time Georgia had hosted Alabama since Mark Richt's last season in 2015. So I think that's significant to note that, you know, he has struggled tremendously against that program. Most of those struggles were against Nick Saban, his mentor, and everybody everywhere except the NFL struggled against Nick Saban in perpetuity. But he's 0-2 against a guy in Kalen DeBoer that, as you have so well chronicled, fans have nitpicked over not having a tucked-in shirt and a hoodie on the sideline. Fans were ready to ride him straight out of Tuscaloosa into the shoals after Alabama opened this season with a loss at Florida State. So that's a weird one because Kirby is such a good motivator and he's typically such a good CEO from a standpoint of having his team always prepared. And you can make a pretty strong argument that it's been coaching malpractice for Georgia the past 2 years in the first half against Alabama, because it was like a 21-point deficit last year in Tuscaloosa in the first half, and this year it was a 21-7 and a 14-0 deficit really in the blinks of an eye.
All right, if I had $400,000 to bet, I would have bet $400,000 on Oregon covering as a 3-point dog. They end up covering that by 9 points, getting a 30-24 win. I thought the way that this game played out was about as painful as it possibly could for Penn State, because you have a team that struggled to score points in these big games, and through three quarters, they had 3 points on 104 yards of offense. They fall behind 17-3. Boo birds are raining down from the whiteout crowd. And with their backs against the wall, Penn State rallied a heroic effort. 14 points in the fourth quarter, 137 yards, and they score at the top of the first overtime to take a lead. And you think in real time, all right, they're finally doing that after more than a decade. They're finally exercising their demons. And then Oregon scores the final 13 points and wins the game. And now Penn State's, you could say back where they started, but even further behind than they've been. What'd you make of this one?
Yeah, you know, James Franklin, I don't know how much sincerity was in his voice after the game to say he gets the fans' frustration. He understands it. He has to own it and all of this stuff. You know, I didn't necessarily find those words striking me as the most sincere comments, but he's 4-21 now at Penn State against AP top 10 teams. I think he's now 3-14 in that time frame with both teams ranked in the top 10. So if you're outside of the top 10, it's never a great shame, particularly to lose to a top 10 foe. But when you're both ranked within the top 10 and you've lost 14 of 17 of those games, you've got real issues. He's what I would call and got Penn State in the hall of very good right now. And they're probably still in a great position to go return to the playoffs, which they have never made consecutively. Last year was the first time they had made the playoffs. And they wouldn't have made it had it not been the first year of the expansion to 12 teams. But they still have what looks like a really tough trip to Iowa mid-month. And right after that, after an open date, they open November at Ohio State, and then they host Indiana. So they're still good, but Drew Aller, just he doesn't elevate those around him very often. And more often than not, you're going to remember Drew Allen and James Franklin for the exact same things, being incapable of truly winning the big game when it has mattered most. And I was at the Orange Bowl in January when Aller threw an unbelievable interception that sealed Penn State's fate and secured Notre Dame's comeback loss and cemented Penn State's come from ahead loss. And then you see last night that the Drew Aller, yeah, Dylan Thienemann made a great play on it, but the ball was underthrown and poorly thrown regardless. And I just don't think Aller, for whatever reason, has that it factor. Andy Koldenecki called, I thought, one of the smoothest plays of the game that allowed Penn State to score to make it 17-16. And I wondered then, Zach, if Penn State, if they felt like they had 1,000% play that was a 2-point play, that they would go for it and try to win it right there in regulation.
Yeah, I thought Koldenecki had an up and down night, obviously 104 yards for three quarters, but I thought he did a really good job of identifying what would work for Penn State and then going to that throughout the game. And I thought he did a good job of playing to his quarterback strengths, which ultimately proved to not be throwing the football. In his losses as a starting quarterback, Aller came in averaging 5.7 yards per attempt. He averaged 5.5 last night, 14-25, 137 yards. Trevor Pena, the transfer wide receiver that, according to Fran Brown from Syracuse, got $2 million to lead Syracuse for Penn State, ended the game with two catches for 16 yards. It's $1 million per catch, not the ROI they were looking for. But he had three carries for 22 yards. Like, I guess credit to Andy Koldenecki for finding ways to get Pena the ball. But if you told him pregame that Pena would have more rushing yards than receiving yards, is probably, well, I hope he takes it in around 99 yards. Drew Aller did some hurt Oregon more with his legs than his arm in crunch time, nine carries, 42 yards. So I thought he called an outstanding fourth quarter. I'd be interested to know Doug's thoughts on the interception. Underthrown, but throwing that concept into the boundary as opposed to the field, I thought was an interesting choice. And I also thought it seemed like since Oregon scored on their first play of double overtime, it seemed like Penn State was trying to equal that instead of leaning into what they'd been successful with in the fourth quarter and overtime.
Now, I completely agree with you there, because I made the comment to a friend late in that game, especially as Penn State just wore down Oregon to force overtime. I thought you finally saw Penn State's physicality taking its toll on Oregon, and they were on the field a bunch in the fourth quarter, and especially the final 7-8 minutes of the game going into the overtime. That was the only time all night that I felt like Penn State consistently won the line of scrimmage with its offensive line that was supposed to be what was going to be the difference in this game to begin with. And look, I will never question Drew Aller's toughness. He was sitting there, blood pouring down his elbow last night. He was running the ball really hard. I love the fact that he repeatedly dove as he was running the ball instead of sliding as he was running the ball. I did think that was an underappreciated bit of football toughness and football intelligence, because some of those dives made the difference in first downs that wouldn't have been had he slid. I think Koldenecki called the best part of his game in the fourth quarter for sure, and that's when Penn State found something. But in that second overtime, yeah, unless you felt like, again, that was your home run play. And, you know, I think they probably threw it to that side of the field because all night long they were not as fast as the Oregon defense. So throwing it to the wide side, I wouldn't like, because you're not going to outrun the Oregon defense. And I thought that showed up all night long.
So now we're into, as we move to the, I guess, the middle third of this season, I think it's fair to say Oregon and Ohio State might be the two, if you combine the Big Ten and the SEC, those two might be the two best teams in those conferences combined. But what you have in the SEC is maybe not a great team, but a whole lot of really good teams. But the difference in those two conferences is now Oregon will go home, take next week off, then face Indiana at home. Indiana will be a top eight, maybe even top five team by the time that game happens. But then after that, Oregon will not face another ranked team all season long. Maybe USC is currently ranked. They'll fall out after losing to Illinois. Washington's a solid team, probably not going to be in the top 25 by that point. That would not happen in the SEC. And so if you're a Big Ten fan, you could say, well, Oregon and Ohio State are better than those, anyone in the SEC. They navigate that fine. But in the it's just a different level, maybe not as any great teams in that conference, but a whole lot of really good teams. And so now Oregon's basically on the glide path to return to a Big Ten championship, certainly return to the playoff, whereas the SEC, you're looking at that champion might lose two conference games.
Yeah, I don't think there's too terribly much doubt that I expect the SEC champion to almost certainly be a multi-loss team. And yeah, to your point, I think that you would probably feel like if you were evaluating the SEC and the Big Ten side by side, you would give the nod to the two teams you mentioned, Ohio State and Oregon, as the top two. And I think I said earlier, Ohio State the clear number one, but I don't know. I think you could make a strong case for Oregon in that spot as well. But then I think probably you have a half dozen SEC teams that you feel like you could match up and have a shot against either one of those teams. And I don't think there's a half dozen Big Ten teams that you would put against the best half dozen from the SEC.
So let's talk about two of those half dozen. Incredible game in Oxford, Ole Miss 24, LSU 19. For me, Ole Miss has a better quarterback than LSU. Is it that simple?
I'm not ready to say that. Because there's weirdness going on with Garrett Nussmeier refusing to discuss whether or not he's injured, while Brian Kelly saying he's completely healthy, and then Nussmeier following that up by saying, I'm not talking about my health at all. I think it's very clear that Ole Miss has a superior offensive line to LSU right now. And then Kawan Lacy is a better running back than anything LSU has going right now. And I think all those elements are kind of where I'm at. Trinidad Chambliss is a gamer. He is a heck of a player. He is like a more explosive, dynamic version of Gunnar Stockton. But I see a lot of similarities in those two when I watch them play. So I think, you know, Ole Miss winning was not at all a fluke. After being behind early, they really controlled that game wire to wire and certainly could have tacked on a late touchdown there if they had wanted to, and won that game 31-19 instead of 24-19. They had the tight end slide down and went into victory formation, and Lane Kiffin relished that moment, probably with as much emotion as you've seen Lane Kiffin have for any one win in his time at Ole Miss. I thought he really emphasized and wanted to punctuate that victory.
I'm sure we'll get Scott's thoughts on it because he was there when we reconvene on Tuesday, but the LSU came into this game as the number four team in the country with based largely on two wins that have lost significant value since they happened. But at this point, I would bet against LSU making the playoff. This team, they ran for 59 yards. Nussmeier was under 6 yards per attempt. And looking forward on their schedule, you've got Vanderbilt, A&M, Alabama, Oklahoma. I'm seeing a 9-3 team that plays in the Gator Bowl or something like that.
Yeah, it's you know, their equity wins, and LSU had gotten two early ones, as you noted. But with that schedule, they've got to find an equity win somewhere else. I don't have a doubt in my mind if they find a way to go 10-2 that they're a playoff team. I don't doubt that whatsoever. It's just, as you alluded to, it's not just those teams left on their schedule, and those are significant in their own rights, but a number of those games are away from home. You know, they're at Vanderbilt, they're at Alabama. Who knows about Arkansas by that point late in the season? They're at Oklahoma. I mean, they're at those three in addition to having a South Carolina team that still provides plenty of danger at home, and a Texas A&M team that's undefeated and didn't look beautiful yesterday, but is going to probably be, like you said, a top seven team when everything shakes out today.
Speaking of A&M, the Aggies threw for 207 yards and ran for 207 yards. And they converted those 414 scrimmage yards into only 16 points, but it was enough because in the fourth quarter, Auburn gained one more yard than you and I did combined in that game.
Yeah, that was Auburn's got real offensive issues. The stat I like even better than that, Zach, and that's a strong stat, is the fact that Auburn was 0 of 13 on third downs in the game. And you'd be hard-pressed to win a money game at home against an FCS foe if you went 0 for 13, although you'd have bigger issues if you had 13 third down conversions in a money game at home against an FCS foe. But going 0 for 13 on money downs and also failing on both your fourth downs, I don't know if I've ever heard of a team going 0 for 15 on money downs, Zach. And I was kind of ridiculing, I think it was Kentucky, because Kentucky was 5 of 15 on money downs in its blowout loss to South Carolina. And obviously 5 for 15 is still infinitely and exponentially better than 0 for 15. And so Auburn's issues are real. They're another team that I like to say is not done losing. And for better or worse, they're another team that's not done losing, and probably a lot of losses still left on that schedule, because they've still got Georgia coming up at home in 2 weeks, and then Missouri right after that. And then they have to go to Arkansas. Who knows what Arkansas looks like at that point in time, but for the most part, Arkansas can score. The Hogs still had almost 400 yards of offense yesterday against Notre Dame. They just stalled out early in that contest with two field goals when Notre Dame scored touchdowns. It's a different game. Instead of ending up a blowout, there was a chance that could have been a 28-21 game near half. And instead, Notre Dame ran away with it and outscored them. After it's 14-10, Notre Dame ran away with it and outscored them 45-3 at Arkansas. But the Hogs still have some weapons. And again, the Tigers still have some losses. It's compounded by the fact that there's been the disjointment with the offense there. That was supposed to be fixed with Hugh Freeze. There's been the disjointment by basically saying somebody different calls plays on first, second, and third down, which, of course, prompted college football's king of trolling, Lane Kiffin, to say, so then who calls fourth down plays? Well, whoever called any money down plays yesterday should give all the money back, because you can't go 0 for 15.
Yeah, it's clear by now that Jackson Arnold's the same guy he was at Oklahoma. All the tools are there, but the processor is a 1988 Intel computer and not what's needed to process defenses in 2025. So it seems, if you're Auburn, it seems far more likely that the defense breaks than it is that the offense figures something out. And bowl eligibility at this point it would be the goal for me, realistically, if I'm Auburn. You're not going to make the playoff.
And I don't know that bowl eligibility, I've talked to people, and I felt like year three, as long as there was forward progress, and Hugh Freeze talked about it back in May, saying, I'm not an idiot. I know what I have to do. I know I have to go win some games. Is 7-5 enough in what's going to be a crazy year? And the SEC, if you feel like the SEC is getting further and further ahead of you, I talked to somebody this week who just said there is a lot of talent on that Auburn team, and it's not being put together for whatever reason.
There was another ranked-on-ranked game that we haven't talked about yet, and that is Illinois getting off the mat after losing by 53 to Indiana. They come home and outlast USC. USC puts up 15 points in the fourth quarter, but it's not enough as Illinois gets a late field goal to win that game 34-32. Through 45 games at SC, Clay Helton was 31-14. Lincoln Riley is now 30-15.
And I think more damning, Zach, is that I believe in his last 25, he's 13-12. I wrote about that the other day with Luke Fickell, the definition of treading water, because Fickell is 15-15 through his first 30 games at Wisconsin, and that's even throwing in a late season bowl win where he decided in a bit of an unorthodox move that he would coach their bowl game after he took over the program prior, after the 22 regular season, prior to the 23 regular season. So 13-12, that's brutal. You had a record setting day from a Kyle Lemon. It looked good. You had a chance. I like Danton Lynn. I think he's a really, really good defensive coach. They've added Rob Ryan to that staff. He's obviously been around the sport forever and knows how to coach linebackers. But in the end, it was same old USC. And they were out-toughed. And when it mattered most, they were out-executed. Somebody on the Football Scoop Picks panel had picked Illinois to win that game outright. I just felt like it would happen. I felt like that Illinois almost was better positioned to beat USC because it lost to Indiana, because it would allow Brett Bielema to challenge his team physically all week and to have it be kind of a prove it game. And that was a prove it game for Illinois, having some more mental and physical toughness right now than USC. USC, credit to come all the way back. I think they were down 24-10. I know they were down 31-17. They scored 15 in a row, but they left a buck 55 on the clock, and that was plenty enough time for the Illini to get it done. And I didn't realize, I think that was the 14th or 15th all-time meeting between those two programs, and that was the most points Illinois has ever scored in that entire time against USC.
Last week, Luke Altmyer was sacked 7 times by Indiana, had a QBR ESPN stat of 43.8. Going 14-22 for only 146 yards. Yesterday, he played a darn near perfect game. Only sacked once, 20 of 26, 328 yards, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions. And I agree with you. There's a lot of talent on USC's defensive coaching staff, but it didn't translate to the field on Saturday afternoon.
No, it didn't at all. And for those keeping scores, we go through here. And there have been some tweets about it, and there have been some names that I think you have to add to the list. But Brian Kelly, James Franklin, Hugh Freeze, Lincoln Riley, Pat Narduzzi, Mark Stoops, they all suffered losses yesterday. All of those guys suffered losses yesterday. And then you can add in Mike Norvell suffering a loss Friday night in double overtime at heavy underdog Virginia. So, you know, some guys that you associate fairly synonymously with college football and college football coaching, and certainly you associate with some of the absolute largest paychecks in the business, got their pants dropped this weekend.
Let's go to Friday night. There's in a vacuum, I don't think we give proper respect to how difficult it is to go on the road on a Friday night in conference play and win. And TCU and Virginia, TCU and Florida State both showed how difficult that is. Both went on the road as ranked teams and lost to unranked foes. The Virginia scene, as great as that Saturday was, the Virginia scene was the best thing I saw all weekend. You had a program that was moribund for years. Virginia football was in many ways Stanford East. They came alive in real time last Friday night, and punctuated by that, we're going to be seeing clips of that field storm. It looked like a basketball field court rushing last night, which was at equal parts dangerous and awesome to see.
Yeah.
Florida State receiver Squirrel White disappeared and didn't reemerge in the video, but thankfully did reemerge in real life, and it seems like everyone's okay. But that was a dangerous scene, but a great scene. And two thoughts I have on that game was you saw some 2-10 tackling from Florida State, some 2-10 discipline from Florida State. But my other takeaway in that game was the transfer portal is a bit like the media or Congress, a nameless, faceless entity that's an easy punching bag. But for all its ills, the transfer portal made that possible. Chandler Morris scored – Virginia paid Chandler Morris $1 million to leave North Texas, and he scored 5 touchdowns last night. He, not by himself, but he's the catalyst in bringing Virginia football back to what it is. And then at the same time, North Texas is 5-0, led by one of the best stories in college football, and Drew Mestemaker, who last started a freshman B game before becoming the starting quarterback for the Mean Green. Neither one of those stories are being talked about right now in a world where there is no transfer portal.
Well, and here's what's even further crazy, Zach, as you take us down the transfer portal trail, and that is Virginia's best receiver from the previous 2 years, Malachi Fields, is now Notre Dame's best receiver, and it's not close. I mean, he has been sensational for the Irish, even though they're just 2-2 through 4 games. And so, yeah, the transfer portal giveth, the transfer portal taketh away. Virginia needed that game. That's a signature win in year four for Tony Elliott, and that's a significant win. And, you know, we'd said on the pod last week, I really like the Virginia offense, and Chandler Morris is playing the best ball of his life. How much does Clemson miss Tony Elliott right now? I think a lot. They probably miss Chandler Morris too. So, yeah, that was a great scene for college football. The field storming was a little uneasy there for former Vols wideout Squirrel White, now at FSU. So, but good for college football overall. Kudos to Arizona State. And another ugly road win, but an important road win Friday night was Houston against Oregon State. And now that sets up Houston, keeps them undefeated, and they get Texas Tech at home in their next game. And you look at Houston, I don't think they're a playoff team, but they have two ranked teams on their schedule right now the rest of the way, Texas Tech and TCU, and one, if not both of those games, are in Houston.
Arizona State's played three games against Power 4 opponents so far. Those games have been decided by 4, 3, and 3, and the winning score, I believe, in all three was scored with less than a minute to play, as I furiously scrolled through the box score. There were 30 seconds to play or less. Arizona State's defense had TCU quarterback Josh Hoover in hell late in that game. Prince Doriba, the Texas transfer, had multiple sacks, including an incredibly impressive strip sack. And then when Hoover was given time to drop back and pass, he couldn't solve Arizona State's zone defense through two interceptions. Could have probably thrown four. Arizona State had a couple balls hit their receivers hit their defenders in the hands that were dropped. So Arizona, I don't know what to make of Arizona State. Is this a team with championship metal, or is this a zombie waiting for a knockout punch? Either way, we'll find out soon enough. They're at Utah and then get Texas Tech at home game against Houston, then at Iowa State. So if they survive that gauntlet, you're looking at the best team in the Big 12 and a repeat college football playoff team. Or they could easily go 2-2 in those games and be out of the mix entirely.
Yeah, and I would probably lean towards the latter of those scenarios, Zach. I mean, I don't want to discount what the Sun Devils did Friday night. It took tremendous culture and team character, I think, to find a way to win that game. But they're much more vulnerable than a year ago, as we've noted. And it's more than Cam Scatabo at this point. There's more than that missing. And so I would contend that Iowa State certainly very much looks the part. Texas Tech very much looks the part. I think the next tier of teams right behind that is BYU, TCU, Utah, and Arizona State. For the Big 12's sake, you know, they need Texas Tech and they need Iowa State to keep winning as much as possible. And they might sit there and try to say, oh, you know, we just want a competitive league. We're the most competitive league in America. But if you want to change the narrative, you need to have two teams that dominate all season long to have a chance to get two teams into the 12-team CFP. And at this point in time, your best bets for that are Texas Tech and Iowa State. Kansas, I thought, just a trash loss yesterday. You can't lose that game at home to Cincinnati. Kudos to Satterfield and Cincinnati and what they were able to do on the road in a sold-out Kansas Stadium. Utah got healthy against Virginia yesterday. What does that mean, as you alluded to, with Arizona State up next on the docket and another game inside Rice-Eccles Stadium after they were virtually non-competitive last week against Texas Tech? So but there's compelling football throughout the Big 12, but that conference needs Texas Tech and Iowa State to keep winning.
We're nearing 40 minutes of this podcast, and we haven't even discussed how Mark Stoops' College Football Hall of Fame bid might have been impacted by losing 35-13 to South Carolina last night.
Yeah, and, you know, presumably straight face, there's been media in that market in the last couple of years insist that a statue should be built for Mark Stoops outside the stadium. I'm not even joking you. And this is the place where Bear Bryant coached, and you want to put a statue of Mark Stoops, who, as someone tweeted out, is 1-11 in his last dozen SEC games. He's 2-13 in his last 15 SEC games. I could keep going. It keeps getting worse. It's ugly. It's a race to the bottom. The two worst teams right now in the SEC, unequivocally, are Kentucky and Mississippi State. But if you watch those teams and you know anything about football, you see two programs in vastly different directions. And Mississippi State is playing good ball. It's playing like it wants to play ball. It's playing with a great energy. It had plenty of opportunities to knock off Tennessee yesterday. It's trending upward. Kentucky is trending below the basement.
Wait, you have Mississippi State below Arkansas?
Well, I think they play in a couple of weeks, so that's fine. You could say the thing about Arkansas is before yesterday, they were like 6 points away from being undefeated, and that was against Ole Miss and Memphis on the road. So to me, that underscored what happened yesterday to Arkansas is where the program is now, and it's got a lot more losing to go. And I think, unfortunately for Sam Pittman, what's going to happen there is inevitable. I've known Sam for a long time. He's a great man, and he's a really good O-line coach, but he's not been able to get that program over the hump since 2021. And you called it 4 years ago. I'll forever remember that. You said the high water mark for Arkansas football was that regular season win against Texas, and nobody knew it at the time, but you wrote it. And so I'll give you exponential credit for that. But yeah, I frankly think Kentucky is the worst team and the worst program in the SEC right now. And it was pointed out to me that in addition to all those stats that I just regurgitated that I tweeted out, that Kentucky hasn't had a home win in the SEC in about 730 days. So literally two calendar years.
Yeah, ranking the SEC from 1 to 16, from 1 to 15 would be incredibly difficult. 16 at this point is not difficult. So maybe our colleagues in the media need to slow down on getting a PO for that statue.
Yeah.
Good gosh. All right. What game is chomping at your bit that we have not talked about yet?
You know, we don't have time to go over it. It was an earlier in the day game. But, you know, Pittsburgh is another program that I think is racing towards the bottom of the ACC right now. And they lost to that West Virginia team with a double-digit lead in the fourth quarter. They had a 17-0 lead at home yesterday against Louisville. Found a way to lose that game 34-27. Some of the video on the sidelines looked like there was some disjointment there. I think they had five turnovers. They benched Eli Holstein at some point. Looked like he and offensive coordinator Kate Bell were getting into it. I just think there's dysfunction and disjointment in that Pitt program right now. Shout out BYU. It wasn't pretty. They dug themselves a 14-0 hole before coming back and winning 24-21 at Colorado. The Cougars remain undefeated. They're getting there on offense. Bear Bachmeyer is tough as nails, runs it well. He's getting better in this throw game. They've got some nice talent. I don't think they're in that mix. I don't think they can seriously challenge Texas Tech or Iowa State for the league crown, but they should be headed to another 8-9 win season. Those are two of the ones. And then Duke getting off the mat, Syracuse showing that life after Steve Angeli looks like it's going to be even more difficult than we thought for the Orange.
I want to shout out Georgia Tech, trailed on the road in conference play 20-3. In mid-third quarter and came back to beat Wake Forest 30-29 in overtime. And on a day when we saw a lot of binary decisions made, I know people were clamoring for Dan Lanning to go for two in the at the bottom of the first overtime because you have to go for two for that point forward anyway. Rightly or wrongly, he kicked the extra point and then won it in double overtime. And Wake Forest, faced with that same situation, went for two and the win in the bottom of the first overtime, and it did not work out for them. Their pass was incomplete. So I'm not saying that was the wrong decision by Wake. I'm not saying it was the right decision by Oregon. I'm not saying Kirby Smart was wrong to go for two for that fourth and one. I just think in these 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10, even 8 out of 10 decisions that coaches have to make in that one situation, you might have to live with the two or three where it doesn't work out for you in that moment. Whereas we as fans just sit home and scream at these guys to just make the right decision every single time and just call the touchdown play. It's so easy.
Yeah. And last one for me, as we encroach upon 45 minutes of this Sunday Football Scoop recap podcast, Shout out to Jerry Mack and Kennesaw State. They won their third game in a row. They beat Derek Mason's flailing MTSU program. They won that game wire to wire. That's significant because it's Kennesaw State's third win in a row. Jerry Mack is a first-time head coach at the FBS level. He was really good previously at the FCS level. But I also want to note, shout out Jerry Mack for that win, because 2 years ago, he was in the candidate pool for MTSU, and he did not get an interview among the finalists. And so yesterday, I can assure you, for Jerry Mack and Jaden Mack, his son, who helps run their personnel department, that was an especially sweet triumph, and they earned it. They've got Kennesaw playing good ball. Tough test coming up with La Tech coming into town, but three in a row for the Owls. So shout out to Jerry Mack and the family.
Awesome. Well, we are past the 45-minute mark, which means we're about to be electrocuted if we don't shut this down. John, it's a pleasure. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next time.